Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Homeseeker, the place where we help Kiwis accelerate towards home ownership. I'm your host, Andy, and today we're tackling a hot topic for potential home buyers, understanding how much deposit you really need in 2024, whether it's for your first home or an investment property. We'll explore the options for bringing families into the mix, joint ventures, or friends, as well as some government benefits that might help. Joining us today is Simon, a seasoned financial advisor who's here to shed some light on this crucial aspect of buying a home. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Great to have you again. Today, tackling how much deposit you really need for a home in 2024. Now, let's get started with the basics. Can you give us an overview of the typical deposit requirements for first home buyers in New Zealand in 2024?
The basics are, it ranges from about 5% to 20% for owner-occupy. There's different criteria for those different junctions. And then you've got the 35% requirement for investor at main bank.
So let's start with the 5%. More limited. Obviously, you need more borrowing power in some instances, potentially. Property prices might vary, but give me a bit of an example of the difference between, say, a 5% deposit and a 10% deposit.
5% deposit is really only supported by a limited number of lenders, and it's in conjunction and partnership with Kāinga Ora. They have their criteria to be met.
Okay, so certain banks, so not every main bank is going to be open to these applications, so it means making sure that your bank is actually going to be open to that.
Yeah, that's right. We've got the likes of Westpac, Kiwi Bank. These banks have got a relationship with Kāinga Ora, but there are other banks out that will do this as well. I think one of the big things that you can do if you're wanting to go to a specific bank is make sure that you're actually banking with them and you've got some experience, say 90 days worth of transactions in one of their facilities.
Because some of the requirements are exactly that, aren't they? That you actually have to bank with them. You can't just be a new to bank to get like a particular loan. They kind of want to see things ongoing basis. So that obviously varies to 10%. 10%, you get a lot more variance with the banks. But again, borrowing power does come into play as well. So let's just talk about the difference between the key differences between 5 and 10 before we move on.
I think one of the biggest things is that some of the restrictions are removed and some different restrictions are applied. And the different restrictions are more to do with whether or not you can really service this lending, and they'll want an additional amount of servicing requirement added onto that application, I guess, you know, to take on the added risk that the bank is taking for the insurance that they have to pay on those low deposit loans. In Kāinga Ora, for example, application, there is criteria on income caps and house price caps and things like this. If you're outside of that and you have really decent incomes, then the 10 to 15% options are there for those clients. And there are a variety of different banks that do that. Some do pre-approvals, most don't, and require a live deal.
What I find crazy about, you know, the live deal is one thing, but what I find crazy about bank to bank is that if you've got a 10%, you just talked about like how borrowing power comes into play. And simply put, that's how much debt you can service, right? Whether it's an individual or a family or a joint application or a family application. It blows my mind that it's different from bank to bank. With one bank, you could potentially get, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousand dollars more than another bank. Is that just because of their, I guess, their policies and around how much they want to lend, their appetite in this 10% area? Can you shed any more light on that?
That last point you bang on, the appetite, that's why it changes.
Right.
And so they have to balance the books with a variety of different types of loans. And you don't want 100% of your lending going out to 10% loans, puts you in a very risky position in terms of the banks. So they have to manage those relationships with their insurer and also the Reserve Bank. So essentially, they've got a limited pool where they go low deposit lending, and they have certain criteria that they would like to be met so that it meets the bank's risk.
Well, that aspect that you just mentioned has like changed so many times in the last couple of years, right? The percentage in which banks, particular banks, are allowed to lend underneath that 20% deposit, right? Is that still the case? Is there still only like, say, 5% or 10% of the book that they can, or does it just vary on?
That is still correct. On top of that, though, there are some banks that are so large, for example, ANZ, they practically have an open ability to take these low deposit loans with live deal contracts. So we can do the calculations, see it works, and then guide the client as to how they go about getting a property under contract. One thing that has changed recently, though, is that multiple banks have allowed you now to utilize border income in low deposit loans. And that makes a massive difference. Previously, and usually, banks will provide and allow you to use, say, two borders in your home.
That's a renter. Someone taking up.
Yeah, someone who's a flatmate is probably the best term. And so now, where previously low deposit loans, the banks were saying, no, we're not going to utilize any border income. It's enough risk for us. They're saying now we perceivably say that you can bring in a border income and you add that to your income to get you through that threshold to allow you to purchase property at that low deposit.
Yeah. Now, obviously 20% is just, it's kind of like the golden nugget, right? You've got access to all banks, you've got pre-approval opportunities, you get cash back, the best rates. Everybody wants you at that stage, right? And there's a massive difference between the banks that will open potentially their doors for 5% versus 10% different criterias, and 20% everybody is sort of there. So you mentioned that the banks that are quite typical for those low deposits and the 20%. Sometimes when people don't have the best credit, for example, there are things or options outside of main banks that could be there for particular people, right?
Correct. And you will have to have strengths in other areas. If you are falling short on your recent credit history, the bank will want to see really good diary notes around that. They want to understand, you know, why did this happen? What are you doing to correct it to make sure it doesn't happen again? Ultimately, they want to know that you're going to pay back the loan they're going to give you, right? And so working with a financial advisor, you can go back and forth and prepare those notes prior to submitting the application. But in short, if we're talking about outside of the main banks, if it's, you know, that bad, for example, and none of the main banks are going to touch you, but you are on the road of improving and you want to say a shorter term product, there are other lenders like ResiMac, for example, who can provide lending for owner-occupier that have those tarnishes against their name, so to speak. But as you say, they come to us, they're working through a process of getting on top of this. They want to move now, right? And we can help them.
Yeah. Now, let's run through a scenario that I actually had the other day. And it was just about a client. They've got a 10% deposit, but they wanted to save more of a deposit before they actually went down the route of looking to purchase a property. And I sort of explained some of the concerns that I had with that sort of approach. Mm-hmm. Or that might work for certain people, but why it might work backwards for you. Mm-hmm. Can you explain maybe why? I know you don't know the case, but can you explain why it might work, I guess, backwards for somebody in this instance?
There are some variables that are unknown. You don't know what the market's going to do, but you can look at trends. And the trend has been since late last year that there's an upward trend in property prices. If we extrapolate that, say 0.8 to 1% per month, month on month for the rest of the year, I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen. But if we did, you could see a position where tens of thousands, if not close to $100,000 extra is what you're going to be paying for that same property. And the question is, can you save at that same rate? And if you can't, then it may be better paying those additional slightly higher interest rates or capitalized fee to get into the property now so that you have, you know, you're riding that wave upwards. And at the same time, you can still pay down debt, save, and then look to upgrade the family home later.
Could be 6 months, 12 months, 18 or 24 months of pain, but I'd rather the pain than not have the opportunity to purchase, right? And I think that aspect really moves into the next segment quite nicely, because a lot of people that I do speak to are curious about the role of family and friends, right? Mm-hmm. They want to buy on their own or with a partner, but maybe one partner isn't working at the time and the family need more assistance. So how can family and friends come together to help meet deposit requirements, serviceability requirements, and what should they really consider before sort of entering these agreements?
I think it's a beautiful thing. I think there is much scope to be had for multi-income type families, whether it be parents and children that are working or brother or your sister couples coming together, because there are a lot of properties out there that can suit this type of arrangement. There are home and income type properties, multiple incomes on the one title. So you can have your own space. You can have, say, 3 two-bedroom units and 3 couples going together, or 2 people with a home and income type approach. This very much puts you in a position of affordability. And so if that's an issue, it can dramatically help people get into that home. I also think, you know, these multi-income type properties are excellent long-term holds as well. So even if you started off there and then held it together whilst you moved into separate homes when you had the capacity later down in life, you've got a great rental to hold on to as well.
And I guess if you look to do things as a family, right, maybe it's mum and dad have the deposit and they might only have 5 or 10 years of working life left if they do retire at 65, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. but you've got the serviceability from the kids, you know, you can almost help each other create wealth within the family, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that really comes down to really strong notes, as you mentioned earlier, a good exit strategy as well. But there are opportunities for people out there to be able to do that. But what are some of the pros and cons to taking that sort of approach?
Well, the pros are that you're joining 4 incomes as opposed to just a 2 or 3 or whatever it is. So you're bringing in additional income that can go towards the servicing of the debt. That is a pro. You get to have essentially 2 houses. It's on the one property, but they are 2 separate houses and and the feel is very similar to having two houses, but with half the price tag. Some of the cons: that there needs to be some mitigant put into place. This is a little bit on the finance side, but especially in the circumstances you just brought up in relation to the older parents, they want to know that what's going to happen when those parents retire and who's going to continue paying that, and is there a plan for that? But more importantly, on the legal side of things, you want to have a clear arrangement. If some people are bringing in more deposit than others, then how does that look? And so speaking to an independent legal advice on both those different parties is paramount.
Yeah, and I think the other opportunity, if you're not going to be buying together, right, mum and dad might already have a home and want to help you in, or maybe vice versa. You know, the kids might have a home and want to help the parents in. People can top up an existing property potentially and then gift that money away, right? Can you explain some of the pros and cons of that sort of approach? Because it's not necessarily just going in on a joint application. Someone may already have the security of a family home already, but really want to help somebody else into one.
The pros of the gifting is that it limits your guarantee on the rest of the debt. Okay. So what I mean by that is if you're guarantoring your kids, you actually take on responsibility for the entire debt. That's not the nicest thing. Mm. What you can do is you can limit your exposure to that by topping up on your existing mortgage and gifting it. Now, when I mention this to sometimes with some clients, it's like, oh, I'm gifting all this money and I'm topping it up. Like, what's going on here? Like, can I really afford this? We go through affordability, but another way of actually going about this is having a deed of acknowledgement of debt. And what that means essentially is that you give $200,000 to the kids to get into their first home, they're not just going to sell it and go overseas and spend it on a nice, you know, 5-year trip or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so the way you guarantee that is by this deed of acknowledgement of debt. It's been written up by a lawyer, or at least cited and acknowledged by the lawyer. And essentially what it means is that it's tied to the asset. So if the kids sell the asset down the track, the $200,000 goes to that person who provided that deed. And then that allows them to get that back and a bit of security on that, and they can make a decision whether or not they want to re-gift it. But I think they're a really good safety catch for the people that are providing those giftings.
Yeah, I think that there are a few common misconceptions as well, right, when you go into joint venture, that the risk is going to be really high. I can't trust this person, they can't trust me, and all of that. But realistically, when you go into these sort of agreements, there are legal documents behind that to protect the borrowers in those sort of instances, right? So if someone needs to sell and the other person doesn't want to, that's written out exactly how that would look, right? And I think understanding that position, like you mentioned, talking and getting legal advice is extremely important, so that when you do go into these arrangements, you have an understanding of maybe what the exit strategy might be. How long do you want to be in this property before you're both potentially looking to move on? How are you splitting the expenses, the mortgage, the debt? All of that comes into it. If I've got 60% of the deposit and, you know, the other person has 40, for example, how is the value of the property moving around? Like, these are all things that we can work in, but as ultimately it comes down to the legal documentation, right, behind that sort of agreement. So like with the changing dynamic, particularly in the property market and over the last 2 years, even 12 months, even right now, how is the approach and investment property side of things evolved pretty much in 2024? Because I know, you know, back in the 2020, 2021, 2022, everyone wanted an investment property. Things slightly have changed. When we do talk about that, how have the deposit aspects, how have they evolved, and what do they look like in 2024 as in requirements?
You're testing my knowledge here. I'm pretty sure it was late 2023.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it was late 2023. They reduced the requirement for investment deposit from 40% to 35%. And so it may not have been 2024, but it's in the last 3 to 6 months that's happened. So that makes difference. There's more equity floating around to be available to use as a deposit for the next home, and people can restructure their mortgage, pull properties out, that kind of thing.
How do the banks look at this opposed to maybe a first home versus an investment? How do they look at it differently when they see a loan being provided to them, like a loan application? How do they assess it differently?
Well, there's requirements based on the RBNZ, and they've set those requirements for LVR restrictions. They have policies in place to ensure that people can't get around that as well. People try all the time, try tricks. So yeah, they're well and truly over it. I guess it's the restriction from the RBNZ, but also I guess the reason why the restriction has come into place is to try, you know, change the market dynamics of how lending is provided to different types of classes of properties. I think it's less to do with the risk.
Yeah. So, but I guess specifically when it comes down to the options you have through a bank when you take lending out, right? Most people understand the idea of principal and interest. When you make a repayment, is most of it's the interest to begin with and part of it's the principal. Whereas banks can be a little bit more favorable to interest-only options, right, through investment properties.
Correct.
There's different, I guess, loan terms and stuff like that. Do you want to kind of just run through the interest-only side of it with an investment and why you might look to structure a mortgage with a portion of interest-only in there, dependent on circumstances, obviously, but just in general?
Yeah, so generally speaking, banks will provide up to 5 years interest-only for investment property. Owner-occupy, you're really kind of maxing out at around 2 years. Maybe you can renew that and extend for another further two. But ultimately, the regulators want to see owner-occupy debt being paid down. As in the best interest of everyone. Now, investment debt is a different thing. Investment debt, you can run as a business. Interest costs can be a legitimate cost and can also be written off. You may not want to pay down the principal because you want to allocate some of that principal to other parts of the business. And so 5 years interest only for investment properties, and that's pretty much where they're going to extend to.
So you've mentioned investment properties, the debt, you know, the sort of criteria and around that. And we've thrown the word equity around, right? So I want to talk about how we can access equity. And the best way I think you might be able to explain this, opposed to telling us how, is if you might be able to explain how you've seen it for one of your clients. What position were they in? How did they understand the amount of equity they had to be able to use? And then how did they go about actually, you know, using that equity?
We use a borrowing summary spreadsheet in our presentations. And this borrowing summary spreadsheet allows us to quickly ascertain what their available equity is. We're using online valuations that the banks will use against their properties. And then we just apply the appropriate LVR restrictions. So owner-occupy 80%, investment property 65%. So that will give us, minus the debt, the available equity. That's the equity we can then use for the deposit on the next time. So that's the available equity you can touch into, can tap into.
And then ultimately you have to top up your loan potentially, or you cross-securitize. What does it look like there?
Yeah, so if you're going to the same lender that has got that property or properties with available equity, you can get 100% lending on the next property because you've got available equity in the others.
Yep. Okay.
So cross security.
Yeah. So what it sounds like is that, you know, as we start to look at the property market and as properties start to go the right direction, ideally, and start to grow in value, if people have purchased now, there could be more opportunity to recycle equity because your debt ideally is decreasing, the property value is increasing. A portion, not all of it, a portion of the difference you can potentially pull out. This might be also for renovations. It's not necessarily just for a second home, but ideally you can use that growth of a property to then put onto another property, which then ideally also grows over time. So now you have two assets and you can continue that trend over a long period of time, right, to start creating wealth for yourself and for your family. So it's an extremely powerful tool, right? But it does take getting in the door to be able to take this sort of approach. I guess lending in New Zealand and the government incentives, that can be a complete game changer for a lot of different people. Can you elaborate on kind of how the current government incentives allow Kiwis to get into the home deposit through the likes of the first home grant, government contributions, and the thresholds there?
Yeah, so we do have first home grant. We've got, it depends on how long you've been in KiwiSaver. 3 years is kind of the starting mark. You get about $3,000. Five years, you're getting about $5,000 for an existing home, each applicant, and $10,000 for each applicant for a new build. So that's $20,000 to go towards a new build purchase. It's a lot of money just given to you through that grant. So we always employ our customers and clients to speak to our KiwiSaver advisors to make sure that, you know, both the KiwiSaver is performing as best as possible to get them the deposit they need, and then also to check whether or not their availability. They'll put them onto the right sources to be able to check that. And once we have a confirmation of that, we can put that as part of the application for pre-approval if needed.
Yeah, I think it's we're quite lucky in this country, right, to be able to have some of these incentives and get forced into KiwiSaver. And it's one thing I wish I started way earlier. I've talked many times about that, so I'm not going to go into it. But I guess there's going to be people out there listening to this who are strategizing their savings for a deposit. What are some advice that you might be able to offer with regards to, you know, putting money away into savings account, income allocation, and things like that?
On a practical side of things, I like to have all money go into one account, and then I set up an automatic payment for my spending. You know, I have automatic payments come out of that main account for all the expenses that don't change really, and then I have an allocation that's, I can, you know, throw up against the wall, so to speak. And so I know when I've finished that for the week or the fortnight, I need to go out and earn some more money.
Yeah,
so.
And I guess the key thing there, right, is when you're strategizing savings, you've got to make sure you put the savings away the minute you get paid, not at the end. You need structure, right? The whole income allocation is, I think, critical to helping grow people's deposit, because you need to get a really good grasp on how much money you earn, where your money is going, and how much you can feasibly put away to build a deposit faster while still also being able to kind of enjoy your life. And I think that's obviously where the Wealth HQ side of it comes into, is we help people understand what that might look like, how long it's going to take them to get there. And it's kind of critical at that early stage, if you can shave off a year or two, or understand that you can actually purchase within 3 to 6 months, you know, you'd rather know that now than down the track in a year's time when it's a little bit too late, right? It's one of those key things. But look, Simon, taking enough of your time already, so I really do appreciate it. Some really invaluable insights there. I think understanding deposit requirements is a critical and vital step towards home ownership. And it's clear that there are several avenues that we can explore, whether it's through personal savings, family support, or government incentives. And I really do love the family support aspect of it, because it brings a lot of people together. So today's listeners, we hope this discussion helps illuminate your path towards purchasing a property in 2024, whether that's a first home or another investment or your first investment. Remember, planning and preparation is key. If you have any more questions, you need some guidance, don't hesitate to reach out. Once again, Andy from the Home Seeker Podcast, helping you guys navigate the journey to your dream home. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode when we go through the ultimate checklist for home buyers in New Zealand in 2024.